Hello, and welcome to episode 97 of Speak Deeply for October 6th, 2019. I'm your first host, Juliana.
And I'm your second host, Marjolaine. And
we have our lovely friend, Jen.
Hi, I'm back again.
Yeah. And actually, it's my first official episode as a regular host because before that,
really?
I was just a guest. So, woohoo!
Yay!
Oh, we should have planned something bigger. I didn't know that.
But I planned something big for my first official episode, I guess. So.
You're definitely coming in with a bang.
That's very true. So, it's Marjo's first official episode. Yay! And Jen, why don't you just remind us who you are, what house you are, all fun Harry Potter and non-Harry Potter related things that we should know about you.
I will do. I was on a few episodes ago, it was actually 79. So it's kind of hilarious that this is now 97. Apparently those numbers just mean that I have to be on the show. I am a Ravenclaw and a Horned Serpent. My Patronus is a nightjar, which when I put it in the dock, Marjolaine was actually saying that she looked it up and she thinks it could be a good new case beast. So just for future episodes, you're very welcome to put that in. It's a real creature, but it is a bit weird at the same time. If you can't tell from my accent, I am in the UK. My muggle job has changed slightly from the last episode I was on when I owned a wool shop, which is now sadly closed, but I'm now working for a knitting magazine. So my boss might actually be listening to this right now because I told her about the podcast and she thought it was amazing. So if you are, hi. I also, if you might remember from the previous episode, I kept talking about how I want more knitwear in Fantastic Beasts, which is still the case. And I still volunteer to knit them if you need me to, Colleen Atwood. My fun fact took me a while to think of, actually. I was like, I'm not fun at all. I don't have any fun facts. But I do actually, I read all of the tie-in books for the films. I can't get enough information. I need all the information. And I write all the fun things that I learned down. And I have a 42k word document, and that's just for Fantastic Beasts. When I have the Harry Potter one, when I open that up, it gets really annoyed at me because the file is so big. It just can't cope. So I'm officially that kind of person.
I love it. I think that's fantastic.
And I don't remember if we talked about it in previous episode, but we have another fun facts for the listener who are following the social media. Maybe you spot Jennifer in the Pottermore. It was Pottermore video for the September 1st.
September 1st. Yeah. You might see me at the very beginning. It's me. I think they talked about it a few episodes ago, which was sweet. I was waiting for the bus. And then I was like, oh, they're talking about me.
Yeah, that was one of the weeks that I did.
Because you were on. Yeah, I was going to say.
I was like, oh, we know these people.
And then I think Michael posted a picture in the common room because it was even like in his library they were showing it, which was just wild that we reached that far.
Famous.
And now for the Phoenix Register.
And now a message from our sponsors.
Hey
Hey you, yes you, the magical cats and dolls waving your wands like bean shooters in a caper. Looking to be on the up and up about Newt Scamander, famous zoologist and world traveler? No need for gossip at the juice joint, just tune your ears to Speak Beastie. And now for as little as one dragon dollar a month, you can make Speak Beastie the Neasles Meow. Support the show at patreon.com and suddenly you're the big cheese, the real McCoy, with exclusive access to swell sneak peeks, bloopers, and behind the scenes features. But wait, there's more. Sponsors can also beat their gums at the joint with access to the Speak Beastie Common Room on Facebook. Now you're really on the clean sweep, flyboy. Get a wiggle on to patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more about becoming a sponsor today. It's the Billy Wigs Knees and How.
We have quite a bit of news this week, actually. My favorite piece of news is the Mina Lima wallpaper they've released. You probably know Mina Lima. They do all the graphic design for Harry Potter and Fantastic Beasts. And they've released some deluxe wallpapers, including the Marauder's Map, the Black Family Tree, Quidditch, Daily Prophet, and the Hogwarts Library. And, I mean, they are absolutely stunning, as usual, with Mina Lima. And I can guarantee, like, they will be beautifully made as well. They're not the cheapest. In the UK, it's £90 a roll. But I still really want them. I'm really tempted to redecorate, even though I have no space for like a wall of wallpaper, but I kind of wanna. What do you guys think of them? Have you seen them?
Yeah.
I just pulled it up on the Pottermore website.
They're
as well.
Gorgeous. I love the Hogwarts Library one. It's all the books are so pretty. Although there weren't any Fantastic Beasts designs, which would have been nice. I'd have liked Niffler wallpaper.
I feel like that would have been a big seller.
I'd have bought that. Yeah, definitely. I mean, they do Niffler everything else because they know it sells.
And I like that. I'm curious to know how many of those $400 beanbag Niffler chairs they've sold over at Potter's
are. I mean, I would probably have bought one if they shipped to the UK. I'm that kind of person. So cute.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I think they're so pretty. And I really like the Hogwarts Library one. I also like the Marauder's Map one. I feel like all of these...
That one is really cool.
Yeah.
I think the Quidditch one was the only one I was kind of like, it just seems a bit more for a child's room.
Yeah, but it looks really, really sweet for a child bedroom. But yeah.
Definitely.
But all of them, yeah, maybe except this one, I don't see it in my home. But all the rest, I definitely want them. But... sadly, I'm just renting my home now, so I don't know if I'm allowed to put this kind of thing on my wall.
Oh no!
Yeah. Well, plus if it's not permanent, you don't want to be paying £90 a roll.
Yeah.
To have it just ripped down by the next tenant.
Yeah.
I am actually going to be redecorating my room soon, though. So I mean, I'm a bit tempted. I'm not going to lie. I am slightly tempted.
You could almost pass, I'm looking at the designs now, you could almost pass this Black Family Tree one as the Lestrange Family Tree, because it pretty much looks the same.
That's a good point, yeah, they're very similar.
Yeah, except the women are actual women and not flowers.
But yeah. The women are real people in that family.
Nice to know.
The next piece of news is similarly merch related. Noble Collection are releasing some new toys, including some Fantastic Beasts, which is always nice to see. They've got an interactive mandrake, which is kind of terrifying. It is like in a little pot, and when you pull it out, it screams, and you put it back in, and it stops screaming, which is cute. They've also got a creature plush, Cornish pixies, and pygmy puffs. And they have recently released, I'm not sure if you guys saw when they released the Bendable Picket. They've now done the same with Cornish Pixies and Dobby as well, which is sweet.
Oh, that's cute.
Just all the beasts. I did actually get the Bendable Cornish Pixie, and he is currently on my curtains. I've got him like hanging onto the curtain rail, which looks really sweet.
Oh,
I love it.
But, looks like he's going to cause some mischief.
But yes, about the mandrakes, that makes me think about the this kind of doll that makes sound. And I don't know if you had this kind of doll, but when you're a child, but I had one who randomly screaming during the night, and it was so creepy. And,
sounds terrifying.
I think the closest thing we had in the United States to that would be a Furby.
I was going to say, I had a Furby. We had that, and it would too, sometimes just randomly go off, which was a bit scary.
Furby!
Yeah.
It's like, you wake up in the middle of the night, Furby! It's like, oh my god!
No, my doll was randomly saying something like, do you want to be my friend? Or something like that.
That is so crazy. In the middle of the night,
it was.
I don't know if the mandrake will be quite that creepy.
Yeah, we're hoping it's like creepy. Although I do have it's a Gryffindor sword. It's a child's one. It's a Gryffindor sword that's like makes a noise if you bang it. But I'm always like, it just falls over in the night and makes noises and creeps me out. So I feel like the mandrake might do something similar when you're least expecting it. It just comes out the pot or something, starts yelling at you.
Actually, I was going to make a noise, but we don't even really... Oh, no, we do. We hear their noise. I was going to say, we don't hear them because they're wearing earmuffs, but they, in Chamber of Secrets, we hear them scream.
Yeah. So the third piece of news is the Wizarding World app is now available to download. It was released on September the 19th. Have you guys checked it out yet?
I have. I'm kind of underwhelmed.
Yeah, I didn't even realize it had been released. I can't remember where I saw that it was. It didn't seem to... I didn't think there was that much fanfare with it that I was expecting. And, I mean, the quizzes and stuff are cool, but the other stuff... You seem to have to click a lot to actually get to actual stuff, yeah. Which is kind of off-putting. If you've just got a few minutes to kill and you're just going on it, there's a lot of... Yeah.
I wasn't even aware that it was out. So I guess it is not in France, because when I saw the news in the dock, I looked in my smartphone and I can't find it. So I guess.
Oh, that's a shame.
But yeah, I guess it's not out in France. So yeah.
Well, we know they've got the sorting hat quiz coming soon, so we can all have identity crises again.
Hooray!
Yay. Really looking forward to that.
Life crises to deal with.
Did you guys, when they changed it, did your houses change?
I didn't resort. I sorted myself like Lord only knows how long ago. And for those of you trying to hack all my accounts on my computer, I've used the same password for like a really long time. And so...
Don't say that on the internet, Julia.
The good thing is, like, it's a really, really, really obscure password that I made when I was like 9. That like... You would have had to know 9-year-old me, like, really well to guess what it even could be. So, unless you were friends with me in, like, third grade, I don't think you could guess it. But, yeah, I was lucky enough that I remembered what the password was. And I was able to sign in under that, so. Still a Hufflepuff. I refuse to take it again.
I got resorted when it changed. Because I just wanted to try it out. I still knew my other password, but... Because I was Ravenclaw, that was what I was sorted when I first did the Pottermore quiz, and I felt that that was so, like, right for me, and then I got resorted as Hufflepuff, so I did have a slight identity crisis, but I think now that it makes sense for me, like, the older I get more Hufflepuff, and kind of, like, a little bit more laid back than I think I was a very intense child, but I still think if I was 11, I would totally be a Ravenclaw, and, I mean, I have ridiculous word documents of all of the things I've learned from various books, so I think that's pretty Ravenclaw.
No, I did like you when I, with the new Pottermore, it was my same account, but I chose to took the test again, and that was a big fail, because I got the last house that I was expecting. I was resorted into Slytherin, and
oh my gosh, really?
But I refused that. I closed this account and never used it again. I create another one, because actually I don't know if you did this one too, but there is online a test that gather all possible question that
the
you can have. I always consider this one to be the more accurate, because I can see exactly the percentage, and Slytherin was always the last one in my different houses. Gosh. So I don't understand how.
Just unlucky that day then.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I was in a mood during this day. I don't know. But yeah, I did it again and I got Hufflepuff. But yeah, I'm always a Ravenclaw. I can't accept another one. So I'm staying a Ravenclaw, and I accept that I'm a secondary Hufflepuff. But yeah, I'm not a Slytherin, no matter what Pottermore says.
Are you gonna do it when they bring the new quiz out?
Yeah, because
I feel like I probably will.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'd be interested to see what it says.
Maybe I'll do like what Marjolaine does and just make a new account and then just delete it immediately. After.
Yeah. They'd be like, that didn't happen.
It's not real.
No, but it was really painful with this Pottermore, because they change everything when you open the website. If it recognize you, I had the Slytherin banner, and it was really.
No.
But,
oh yeah.
But no, I'm not a Slytherin. Yeah.
That's tough.
But recently, it was Alohomora who did. An episode about sorting and about dual houses, and
oh yeah, listen to that.
Yeah, and they shared a website that I didn't knew about, who go really deep into another way of sorting yourself, and and I got Gryffindor with that, so
I guess you just want to help it.
So I guess I can choose, and I choose Ravenclaw.
There you go.
That's a good choice.
Classic hat stall. Is that all the news we have for the week, Jen?
It is indeed. And I think I can see some owls flying in.
Okay, so this week we have a bunch of owls that have just flown into my apartment. So our owl posted in response to episode 95's podcast question, which was, do you think Leta's death enacted any sort of sacrificial protection for Newt and Theseus? We have some comments from Anne, one of our hosts. In response to the question of the week and Leta's sacrifice, I like the idea that it caused some sacrificial magic a lot, but I don't believe she's dead. As proof, I've attached an image from Calling All Witches, a Harry Potter tie-in book, and focus on the last paragraph. And that paragraph reads, after revealing that Credence Barebone was not Corvus Lestrange, Leta attended Grindelwald's rally in Paris. Grindelwald invited Leta to join his side, but she refused, heroically attacking him and destroying the apparatus he used for his visions. She was last seen consumed by the flames of Grindelwald had cast. Now, I know that sounds pretty final, but compare that to the last sentence from Tonks' page. Quote, sadly, Tonks gave up her life in the Battle of Hogwarts. End quote. Here's from Bellatrix's page. Quote, just as Bellatrix was about to deliver the killing curse upon Ginny, Molly took her out. End quote. And finally, Lily's. Quote, Lily bravely faced Lord Voldemort and sacrificed her life to save her son. End quote. So three women we know are dead, and had very concrete references to death. Gave up her life, took her out, sacrificed her life. Whereas Leta was last seen, quote unquote, to me, that means that that was when we last saw her, and we will very likely see her again. What are your thoughts? So what did you ladies think of this comment?
I would kind of like Leta to be alive. I just really enjoyed her as a character. I'd like to see more of her, but I think my owl post is read on a few episodes ago. I really don't think that Credence could be a Dumbledore, so I don't think they do two fake outs. Like, they couldn't do that and then, oh, Leta's not dead as well, because then what was the point in the second film? So I'm not sure, really. I think it would be nice if, like, Leta's sacrifice protected them. I think that's a really cool callback to, obviously, Harry Potter and all the sacrificial magic we saw in there. So I don't know. I'm not sure how I feel. Oh, there was also Shannon mentioned the moral event horizon in films. So like when it was revealed that she killed a baby, she probably then wasn't going to survive. So I'm not sure how that would work.
Yeah, you make a really good point.
Yeah, I agree with you about, I don't really want Lita to be alive, even if that sounds harsh, but no, I love Lita. But like you said, I think her story is done and her arc is done with this movie, and I don't see why she will be alive again. I don't know to do what, but but about the book that Anne is quoting, I don't think we can take that as a solid clue, because I don't think the authors of this kind of book, even if it's official, I don't think they know anything more than us about the future plot. And maybe it's a conscious choice to keep that open, but I don't think it was an instruction to keep it open in case Lita will come back. Maybe the authors are like us and are not sure about that. But really, I think only Rowling and a few people around her who are writing the script know something, and definitely not the authors of this kind of book. So
that's a really good point, because I read quite a few of them. They can sometimes be contradictory, and even sometimes, especially for Fantastic Beasts and like the Crimes of Grindelwald ones that came out the day the film was released, some of the stuff in there wasn't stuff that had then happened in the film. It was obviously things that had been cut. So yeah, I do think that could make a difference. Like you say, the only people that know really are Joe and the people writing the script. That makes sense.
Yeah,
I definitely agree that the only people we should take to the exact word to the death, I guess, would be probably Joe, because I imagine whoever wrote this book, because I did see this book pop up on my Amazon feed, because
it looks
Amazon,
like a really good book.
Yeah,
I was thinking, I was like, you know what, if I had a daughter, like, this is totally a book that I would buy for her, like, immediately. So, but I mean, it looks like an amazing book, but I'm 100% sure J.K. Rowling did not write it, and I'm pretty sure that this person who wrote it probably actually hasn't really talked to Joe or doesn't know her on a personal level where she would actually get the information that Joe herself is keeping from, like, the freaking cast members. The cast members don't even know what the heck is going on in the movie that they're going to be in half the time. So I don't think she's telling this other random author, you know, I'm bringing Lita back. I didn't tell anyone else. Eddie has no idea. It's just, yeah, I agree with both you ladies. It just seems unlikely that we can take that wording to heart. And I feel like this is just my opinion, but I feel like there are enough characters in this movie already. If we bring back another one, it's just going to make... There are already too many hands stirring the same pot. Like, let's be real here.
Yeah, but I agree with Anne that the way that it is formulated is quite open in comparison with the other characters. So maybe in the first draft of the book, the author write Lita is dead, and maybe someone who don't know everything but know enough to be aware in the Wizarding World franchise that something must be kept open. They ask specifically and this paragraph to stay open or not, or maybe we are just overthinking about one quote.
But... As usual. I mean, you can't not, though, with this kind of stuff, can you? Because Joe does it all the time.
Yeah.
That's very true. But that is all we have for the owl post for this week. Luckily, the owl only left one little poop on my rug, so I can clean that up. So we'll see you later, owl. So for our main discussion this week, we have a lovely, lovely, lovely surprise from Marjo, and I'll let you take it from there, Marjo.
Yes. So Dear listener, I guess we are spoiling you with very special guests and interviews these days. So after Mr. Dan Fogler in the last episode, we are happy to bring you another actor from the last movie. So yes, I had the honor to meet and spend some time with Yusuf Kama himself, William Nadilan, and I brought you a souvenir from this lovely moment. So yeah, maybe for the people who are again following our social media, you know already that I went a few weeks ago in an event near Paris. So it was a magical event, and I need to shout out to La Plume de Poudlard, who organized this event. So La Plume de Poudlard in French, it means Hogwarts feather. So yeah, for you to know.
Oh, that's really cool.
Because Poudlard is the French for Hogwarts. Yeah.
Sounds much cooler in French, though.
I know.
And it's funny because the translator chose a word that could look English for a French reader, but we pronounce it in a very French way. It's Poudlard, but when we see Poudlard, we can think it's English and not French, but that's funny. So yeah, so La Plume de Poudlard is a French fan site, and it was the first time they organized an event like that, and they did something big actually. So it was an old wizarding village with many creators from the fandom, and we had a show around the wizarding world that was called Wizard Spectacular, and we had a fan meet with two French actors from Crimes of Grindelwald, so William Nadilan, Yusuf Kama, and Brontis Rudowski, Nicolas Flamel. And it was, for both of them, it was the first time in a fan event. So yeah, and I can tell that both of them were pretty impressed by the enthusiasm of the fans, and they were really happy to be here. And so we had the Q&A with them on stage, but I will talk about that later, because we learned a lot during this Q&A. And later in the day, I had the chance to record an interview with William, because Brontis had to actually go to theater because he was on stage this night. So yeah, but William spent all day with us, and so we recorded an interview, and I guess now I let you listen to it right now. And we'll go back to the Q&A after that. Thank you, William.
My pleasure.
And my first question is that it's your first time in a Potterhead event. Mm-hmm. So how do you feel now that you are completely part of this world with all these fans around you, and you spent I don't know how many hours just before this interview with photos and autographs. So what is this experience for you?
It is. At first, I was pretty nervous for many reasons. First, because I was wondering, is this really necessary? Am I needed? And then I was a little bit scared, because the fact is, I read somewhere that someone said that I wasn't a fan of the Harry Potter world. That made me laugh a lot, because I was saying it to someone else, so I'm sorry if I repeat myself, but my mom is Indian, my dad is African. Those are countries where storytelling is extremely strong. That's the way the culture goes about. And magic is something normal. It doesn't come from some imaginary world, or it's normal. I grew up without ever hearing about someone dying of natural death. It always had to do with witchcraft. So that's something that's very familiar to me. And when I discovered the Harry Potter world, it felt good. It felt good for me to see that someone could write a saga like that and have such a warm welcome from all over the world. So I felt she made the world more normal for me, because I realized that everybody could relate to that. But the thing is, I've seen the films and I've just started reading the books. And around me have people who've read the books. I was basically coached by some kids from my family during the film when I realized I was doing that. First, I really gained a lot of points in my own family with the kids. Because all the films I did before, they couldn't care less. And the plays I did and all that, I really didn't give a damn. But me doing anything that was related to the, Wizarding World, for them, I became okay. Someone
now could, you're cool.
Yeah, now I was cool. And so I got a lot of coaching from them. But the fact is, it is intimidating to come in such a place where virtually anyone in the room would know more about the Wizarding World than I do. So, and I thought, okay, am I going to disappoint people if, they think I am the character? Am I going to have to remind them I'm just an actor trying to do his best? But everybody was so nice. And then I realized that, in fact, all they needed me to do was to be the ambassador of the film, just to be there to allow them to, dream on.
Yeah, I feel connected.
Yeah.
So,
and also, I really projected myself into them because this is what made me become an actor. I was always a fan of someone. I had the groupie thing inside of me. I always wanted to see what was behind the stage, how the actor was, were they speaking in a normal tone of voice, and who, So, yeah, I feel connected.
Cool. So, if we talk about now about your past career and your past actor career, you did a lot of theater and classical tragedy. I saw that you played Rodrigue on the Cid and Hamlet from Shakespeare. And I'm quoting these two because both of them are characters who are seeking revenge for their father. So Yusuf Kama is too. Yeah. So. Yeah, the storyline of Yusuf Kama is very close to a classical tragedy one. Mm-hmm. So is it a coincidence, or did you talk about your past experience with this specific role to the crew of the film to make them connect Yusuf Kama to classic tragedy? Or
it was totally random.
Yeah.
It was totally random. I guess they were looking for someone who could play French. They weren't necessarily looking for a French actor, because you've noticed my character doesn't say a word of French. They just needed someone to be able to have some sort of French accent. And considering that, I think half of the actors I know have played Hamlet. But I remember telling Mrs. Rowling that it was striking for me to see how compelling was Yusuf Kama and all the changes that she made, because from the first time I read the character to the moment I started performing it, she made some changes, slight tiny changes, and it made it my favorite character in the whole film. I mean, if I had to choose one, it would be Yusuf Kama, and I guess that's because it is in tune with my own vibration. And I told her that, and that's why I love this question, because I told her, you know what, this with Hamlet are my two favorite parts. And she smiled. And indeed, that I like the ambivalence of the character. I like the tragedy of the character, because we're always there between the comical side of life and the tragic side of life. And I like the fact that this character is walking on the edge of a blade, and he could flip one side or the other. And for me, he is where he is because of the people he meets. He was who he was because before meeting Newt, the only person he ever listened to was his dad. Newt is the first person that strikes him as someone who could have something to tell him. And of course, the reunion with Lita changes him. But he's, nothing is taken, nothing can be taken for granted with Yusuf Kama.
Of course, I have a lot of specific questions about the story, and you just talk about how maybe the script changed a bit during production, and so we are, because in Speak VST we are close to 100 episodes, so we talk a lot about every detail of the two movies that we have so far, and so How did this work concretely on set with the story? Because it's so complex and there are so different storylines. And what an actor like you, what do you have? Do you have access of every detail that you need, or do you have to add something? Or and if the changes come during production, how does it work? And when you see the final movie, was it surprising to see or something change maybe after the fact? So yeah, I was rumbling a bit, but maybe you understand the...
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's the way cinema is done. And I heard David Heyman talking about it. The expectation of the spectator, especially with something like this, people have been watching the Harry Potter world for a long time, so they do have expectations. People have read the books, so when they go and see the film, they have expectations. They can be happy or disappointed, and it's part of the game. You can only do this much with this much money and this much time. And the fact is, people are waiting. Sometimes it would take... I have a friend who... I was just in a movie not long ago. We finished filming 2 weeks ago. And I asked the director, who is an Oscar-nominated director, and I said, so when did you start writing this film? He started writing the film 8 years ago. So he's been working on the film for 8 years. When you do Fantastic Beasts, then you have an appointment with the audience 1 year after, you don't get much sleep. So you can only cram this much in this amount of time. This is a bit of a digression, but on set, the changes are really tiny. Because when you change something, then it means it can imply a change in costume and a change in set.
Yeah, and so big you can't change everything.
Yeah. So you have to think ahead, especially when the writer is writing as you go. You know, I think it was Stuart Craig, the set designer, who was saying that, talking about the problems he had with the Quidditch Stadium when all of a sudden it appeared when no one ever told him about Quidditch before, a Quidditch competition. So he had to rethink the organization of Hogwarts and the land around to include something that wasn't supposed to be there. I think there was a clock tower at some point that caused problems as well. And if you look carefully at all the episodes of Harry Potter, there are some inconsistencies. Of course, because when they first shot it, they didn't know what was going to happen because it is J.K. Rowling's incredible mind. I mean, this woman has, I don't know how many brains she has in that beautiful head of hers, but, you know, it's fascinating. So on set, I think when they craft a part for us, there's this much room for us to fill. That's why they actually hire human beings to play those parts, because they know, they can anticipate that this person is going to have this sort of imagination, this sort of vibration, this sort of color. And that's the organic part of it. He's going to fill it with that. Now, about knowing what was going on, I got the script at the last minute. I mean, I got the script like just a few days before the table reading. And the table reading had the main actors around the room. And it's only then that I was able to grasp the whole spectrum of the story. But what I read and what I learned isn't the film I saw, because the end changed, for example. There's some scenes that disappeared. Things were just wired differently in a very, very beautiful way. And it took me five times watching the film to actually finally sit down and say, yeah, I got everything. Because there's so many details. And that's what I love about this particular one. Some people don't necessarily love it that much, but that's exactly what I love. The hidden things, the different layers, you know.
Okay, so if we're talking about some details, we are intrigued by the water dragon parasite that Yusuf had on his eyes. And can you tell us more about that? And does it have a double meaning? And where is this water dragon that we want to see? And
I've seen the water dragon in my imagination. The water dragon is that's again something that's not solved. And I think a lot of things are not solved because they will be potentially developed in the following episodes. And also because there's always this part of mystery that is essential to the storytelling. If you give out all the details, then there's nothing for the spectator to munch on, you know. But to my knowledge, this has been a misunderstanding for Yusuf Kama. Yusuf Kama is a person who's very lost, he's very lonely, and he suffers. He really suffers. Originally, and I think I'm not spoiling anything here, but my character was way more damaged than that. Those are the few changes that occurred as we were working. But at some point, my character was losing some hair. His skin was different. He was closer to an animal than a man because of the suffering and because of what was eating him up from the inside. And so he is in a confusion of pain because he has this unbreakable vow that is literally eating him up. And if he does not accomplish his task, he will literally die. As simple as that. He's dying. So for him, it's that he has only this much amount of time left before he dies.
So he was already dying because he couldn't... what you say, he was already damaged because he couldn't so far accomplish the vow, so
yeah.
He was already dying. So
yeah.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if you follow the story carefully, and some people told me it took me three viewings to understand what Yusuf Kama is about, because it is complex. Yusuf thinks his mission has been accomplished because he thinks Credence is dead. Until the moment he hears about Credence coming to Paris. So one could wonder, wait, so if he thinks Credence is dead, why is he suffering? Because the vow should be,
mm-hmm.
you know, calm now. So this pain could be a signal for him that, wait, no, your mission has not been accomplished. So the guy is still alive. You need to kill him. Unless he wasn't really after the right person. You know? And at the same time, he will realize after a point that the pain he's having is not just that, it's also the parasite.
Mm.
And all this trouble he has, all the pain he has, when he leaves the cave, he says something in the lines of, I have to kill him, I'm sorry. You know, he wants to be nice, but he says,
it's
I have to kill him.
Me,
if I don't kill him, I'll die.
Mm.
And in fact, he realizes that in fact he is being, the pain he has comes from something else. So for me, he has been in trouble for too long and there's a confusion. And he doesn't really know that the people, that the beings he's spending his time with, because obviously I think he spends more time with beasts than with humans, they're not necessarily good for him.
Okay, so I think
je pense
we, yeah.
Pour la dernière question.
Yeah,
je fais le rôle d'attaché de presse. Hein,
so at the end, we think that Yusuf has chose a side because he fight with the other against Grindelwald. But it was before that it was a great character. So what do you think? How do you think Yusuf sees Grindelwald in? What happened for him during this scene, and is he really with the good guy at the end? And I know you can't tell us what you know or don't know about the future of movie 3 and so on, but what do you is Yusuf Kama on the good side now, do you think? Or maybe you can't say that.
I read somewhere there was discussion on the internet about, do you like Yusuf Kama? Or do you? And there was this woman who said, no, this is my favorite character. And another person said, how can a potential child murderer be your favorite character? And I understand all that. The fact is, for me, his mission still has not been accomplished because he's just been told that Credence isn't the person he's looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's still on a mission. At the same time, he rescues Nagini. He's the one who rescues her. At the same time, he participates to containing Grindelwald. There's only five people. There's Newton, his brother, Flamel,
Tina
and Yusuf. Those are the people.
Yeah. And all of them are on the bridge at the end at Hogwarts, so it could mean something.
It could mean anything.
Yeah, so I guess we have to stop there. But I have a question about the prophecy and what do you think about this Tycho Dodonis prophecy? But yeah, it's one of a mystery, I guess. Yeah. But thank you so much.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Yeah, I hope that we will have more time next time to go into every detail.
Anytime.
Thank you.
And thanks for your questions, both of you. They were very smart.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So I hope you liked this part one, because yes, it was only part one. But because after that, the day after the event, I had the surprise, the big surprise, that William contacted me to plan another fun interview so we can continue our conversation, because actually we were quite late during the event, so we didn't have as much time as I hoped, and William was so kind to contact me to plan another interview. So you will have part two in a minute. But before that, I wanted to talk about the Q&A with him and Brontis, because I recorded everything, but of course it was in French, so we will not have that on the show. But I can talk about a few points that I learned, that I found interesting. So, yeah, and we will keep everything Bronte say about Flamel for another episode, because I guess we need to do a whole episode about Nicolas Flamel. So
definitely, so interesting.
Yeah, and but Bronte talked about the Phoenix book, in which he talks with Eulalie Hicks, and it was really funny because it was a question from the audience, and he looks like he didn't know what he was allowed to say or not. But he said that during the shooting of this scene, he didn't knew who he was talking to in the book, and so he asked David Yates, and because he needed enough context to play with, and he said that he didn't really told me, but he shared that that it was like a resistance network, like an underground network. And about Eulalie, he said that she's someone else in this resistance network, but you will see more of that in movie 3. So yeah.
No.
So she's in the next movie, and he said that's all that I can say about it. So, so
that
we already
sounds suspicious.
Yeah, we already knew about Eulalie Hicks, and that we will see more of her in the next movie. But I find it pretty interesting, this resistance network. We kind of guessed that, but having the confirmation by Flamel himself, it was pretty cool.
Maybe it's like, because obviously with the Phoenix book, it'd be really cool if it was like the original Order of the Phoenix.
No, it's me who called that the Phoenix book. He just said
didn't it have book, a Phoenix on it though.
Yeah, it so.
So it could be the OG Order of the Phoenix. That would be really cool.
And I think it's the group of friends that Dumbledore was talked about in the classroom by, I don't remember his name, the guy from the ministry.
Oh,
yeah.
Travers, is it?
Yeah, it's Travers, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Travers said that he's watching Dumbledore's friend, and I think that's this network. Yeah,
that's a good point.
So, yeah, another fun thing was that Brontis and William knew each other before Fantastic Beasts, and it was a complete surprise for them to find the other on set. So, because everything was so secret that they didn't know about the rest of the cast before going on set.
Gosh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so William was already shooting for a period of time, because Brontis had few scenes, so he... When he arrived, William was already there, and And yeah, William said that he was really happy to see Brontes because he described the shooting as being very long. It was 7 months for him. And he said that, so it's a translated quote, during the shooting this long, there is some hollow periods and you try to catch every bit of magic to stay enthusiastic. And it was a real blessing to see Brontes show up like that with his Philosopher's Stone. So, so yeah.
It's really cool. Had they done a film together before or did they just know each other?
I don't know, actually. Both of them had a big theater career, so I guess they did some play.
At some point. Yeah.
Not in cinema. I don't think so. But because Brontes Jodorowsky is actually more a theater actor on stage than a movie actor, so. But Brontes Jodorowsky is quite. William described him as one of his hero. He admired a lot Brontes because. I don't know if you know that, but Brontes Jodorowsky is the son of Alejandro Jodorowsky, which is a big movie maker and artist and an awesome artist and very well known. So, William admired a lot this family and Brontes, and he was talking about that. And they spent a lot of time together during the set because, of course, there was the... They were the two French guys on the
set. That's really sweet.
Yeah. And somebody asked them in which Hogwarts house they are. And Brontes did the Pottermore test that we were talking about earlier. And he is a Gryffindor. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. And William didn't answer actually about him, but he chose to answer about Yusuf Kama. instead of him. So he thinks Yusuf should be in Gryffindor, but everything that happened to him makes him a Slytherin. And actually, in the first part of the interview, you heard a very deep analysis from Yusuf's character from William, and it fits that, I guess. But he said that actually, of course, Yusuf was not in Hogwarts. So he guessed that maybe he went to Beauxbatons or maybe in Ouagadou because he thinks that Yusuf's father was in Ouagadou. And so that's his heritage. So that was interesting. William seems pretty interesting about Ouagadou and he wants to see more about that.
I like your note here that you think William's a Ravenclaw.
Yeah, you can.
I do that too. Whenever I meet people, I just sort them in my head.
After the interview, I definitely think he's a Ravenclaw. The listener can help me sort him, and I will tell him.
Yeah, hit us up on social media. Let us know what house you think he's in.
Yeah. Of course, the audience asked them about Johnny Depp. And it was funny because it was a cosplayer dressed as Grindelwald who asked about Johnny Depp. So it was really, really convincing Grindelwald. I took some picture of him. He was pretty impressive.
Oh, I saw those. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
So Brontes said that he didn't have seen with him, but he saw him just one day when he was visiting the set during the scene in the, I called it the auditorium, but I don't know how you say the big mausoleum. Yes, the mausoleum.
Yes.
And it was funny because it was a day, Brontes was waiting for his scene in the graveyard for more than a week, but because this scene was shot on location in Highgate, they were waiting for the rain to stop because it was raining too much in London during this day, during this week.
No surprise.
So Brontes had to wait, and during the waiting, they shot this a part of this scene in the mausoleum. So Brontes asked David Yates to come on set because he was too bored in his in his hotel, of course. So yeah, so that's when he saw Johnny Depp, and so I quote him, I felt a great simplicity in him. I was expecting him to be always surrounded by bodyguards, assistants holding him coffee, but not at all. He was very calm, cool, taking David Yates by the shoulders, saying hello to every extras. He played his scene very simply. So yeah, that was funny to have this kind of inside look. And of course, William spent more time with him on set because they had more. I guess only the mausoleum scene took so long to shoot that they had to spend more time together. So he said, I was extremely moved by him. He is a great actor. He is an acting beast. He lives for acting. When he starts to play, he transforms himself. And William talked about Grindelwald's speech and how impressive Johnny Depp was, and the audience was really captivated, and it was really powerful to be there. And he says Johnny Depp has always his own team around him, so he contradicts with Pontis, but so he always have 5 people, 2 bodyguards. And on set, I think we were about 1,000, so it's really a small town, a big community, and he was always faultless. And we spent 2 or 3 evenings together, and I meet the real person behind, deeply scared, but he managed to still give joy around him. So yeah,
to hear from people who actually work with him after there was so much controversy about him being in the film.
Yeah, I was interested to watch how they respond to this, because of course in the audience, I think most of the people are just fan of Johnny Depp and don't care about the controversy. That's what I felt, but I was quite not in the same mood than the other, and was more interested to see if there is something else that they can say. But they looked pretty genuine about the way that they were talking about Depp, so I guess he was a good guy on set.
Nice to see.
But speaking of another good guy that we all love.
Oh, we all love him so much.
Yeah, William talked about Eddie, and I loved what he says about him. So he admired him a lot, and he said, I love to watch him work. This man is a love magnet. Everyone loves him. And he managed to always stay calm. He's always working. That's how I imagine Charlie Chaplin was. It's impossible to see him just relax, take a coffee break during the day. He's always working off on his movements, how his character moves. He is in his own world. We watch him see things we can't see. He sees the creature that aren't there. He always has this really strong imagination. So I told him I asked him how he managed the transition between the moment when everyone is around on set for the final touch of makeup, costume fitting, and the moment when we say action. How he keeps his extreme concentration. He told me he protects himself. From the first day on set, he stays not too familiar with everyone around, so everyone leaves him space to concentrate. So yeah, you
can definitely see it, I think, in his performance, how dedicated he is to you and to doing it perfectly, and it really shows. And I think that's one of the reasons why fans love him so much, because he cares so much. He does it perfectly, and he makes Newt a really, really great character.
Yeah, and I was really interesting to hear. I understand that William loves to talk about acting techniques, so you will hear in part 2 that we go deeper in that. And I wanted him to talk about other actors, so so you will hear that in the rest of the interview. But of course, everyone was asking about J.K. Rowling and if they had chance to talk with her. And it was really funny because Pontis didn't have the chance to talk with her, and that's because of the famous croissant scene. So
no way.
But they talked about this scene so much. It's really, really funny. And so because this scene was really tricky to shoot because we already hear that in interview, but Yates wanted to have natural sunrise lightning. So they only had 15 minutes each day to shoot. So it took them so many days to shoot. And Joe visited the set when they were shooting this scene, but nobody was allowed to leave the set while they were waiting for the right time to shoot. And when they were finally free, Brontis asked where was J.K. Rowling, but she already left because they said that she was already so busy writing the next movie. So
he didn't get to meet her. That's so oh, poor guy. That's
disappointing.
But yeah,
maybe in the next one.
Yeah, but he said, but Yates told me that she wanted to see Nicolas Flamel and and how I was playing him, but yeah, he didn't have the chance to talk with her. And William saw her too, and he said that she always was really, really quiet and really discreet and careful to not step on David Yates' work. And I didn't translate everything, but William took his time to talk about the very strong friendship between her, David Yates, and David Heyman, and how this trio succeeded to keep the nicest family atmosphere under production, and how they feel like the whole crew was really bonded around this friendship that the three of them had. So that was pretty nice to hear that. And
that's sweet to hear.
Yeah, and Brontis noted that the fact that they kept absolutely everyone from the first film, even the drivers were the same than the first film. So everyone was feeling like we already did one movie, we are doing another, and we know each other really well now. And it was an important part of this ambience. And he said that it was almost like a theater company, like everyone knew everyone. And
from the the audiobook they did, called Something Magic. They from that, it seemed like a lot of the people who were also doing Fantastic Beasts were doing Potter as well, so it does seem like it is like a big family atmosphere, which I think is really nice.
Definitely. And I didn't translate everything, but it was funny because in the studio, at the same time, next to it, they were shooting Mission Impossible. It was maybe just before that. And William said that, of course, for him, it was the first time that he worked in this kind of big franchise and big Hollywood studio and this kind of thing. But he heard from the people who were working in Mission Impossible or other, I don't remember which other movie they were shooting there, maybe not one Warner Bros. Movie, I don't know. And he said that the ambience that he was experimenting in Fantasy Beasts, the other people said that it's not usual in a big production. It's really specific of this trio, Yates, Heyman, and Rowling. They really created something that is pretty exceptional for this kind of production, with so much pressure on them. Everyone was still pretty cool, and yeah, it's not the case in every movie. So yeah, and I want just to finish with some painful anecdotes. It was pretty funny to hear, even if it's not so funny for them. But William talked about the scene when they removed the parasite from Yusuf Kama's eye, and he said They shot a very, very close-up of my eye with a special camera, and my eye got infected by the hand of someone who was manipulating it. And I saw it coming.
Poor guy.
And I don't get it justice, but the way that he told that, it was hilarious. And Brontis injured his hand with the dragon claw from Flamme's wand during the Wands into the Earth scene at the end, because he said that he wanted to make it turn into his hand to look cool, and and he hurt himself with it, and he say so this one has my blood on it, and it's now truly magical.
Maybe that's why the spell works.
Yeah,
that's great.
So yeah, that's some part of the Q&A who was really, really fun to listen to. And I guess now it's time to part two of the interview. So thank you, William, again for this part two of our interview.
My pleasure.
And so about this Q&A, I wanted to talk about you, about something that you said about being in an international cast. And that you can watch actors from different acting school background, different techniques, and I love the way you talked about Eddie, for example. So I wanted to talk with you about that, because in Speak Beastie we are international too. We are American, British, French, German, and that's just talking about the host. So what's your and that's our favorite thing, that is our favorite thing, to discover the culture of each other. So can you tell us more about the difference you notice between the approach of everyone, the difference between American, British, French actors?
All right, well,
a big question.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I tend to consider every person like its own country. So we are bound to our culture, the culture that we are issued from, and the country and the language we speak, and sometimes the gender and all things that have been put upon us. But deep down, I like to think that everybody's original and comes with a completely original approach. Now there's the training and the education, and that of course allows us to sometimes have, sometimes unfair, but sometimes, funny strokes that allow, to say, okay, we have French actors, Russian actors, we have German actors, French actors. But in general, I don't like to generalize, but I would say that the way acting is taught in France is very different from the way it is in Japan, for example. That's a very good example, because in Japan, I have a friend who's a Japanese actor called Yoshi Oida, and we worked with the same director on stage called Peter Brook. And we have another friend in common called Kaori Ito, who is an actress and a dancer and a choreographer. And she was explaining to me that in Japanese acting, for example, you basically have, I think, three or four basic characters. So those are four types. And what you do is basically mixing all the types or basically combining types together. But you don't go as far as inventing a fifth type. In academia, you don't invent your own. You basically compose from what is there. It's a bit like in music. When you write music, you would use the notes that actually exist, and you would not think of using a new note except in modern music that doesn't belong to the alphabet of music that's in classic music. So in acting, it differs from country to country, and I know that there's a lot of respect for method acting in America, and there's been a lot of schools that emigrated to America from Russia, from Poland, from England, of course. So there are things I notice. There is something very relaxed and very improvised when it comes to American actors. For example, Dan is a very good example. Dan Fogler. My God. Dan Fogler is officially crazy. he can improvise from anything. And I was so smitten with his character. His Dan has he has a capacity of improvisation which is quite remarkable. He has a different rhythm, and he can basically improvise from anything in such a clever and witty and dynamic way. It's really inspiring. So that is something that is specific to Dan, but I think he also has in him culturally a sort of Brooklyn vibe that's typically American. I don't see an English actor or a German actor or a Finnish actor reproducing the same sort of thing. That would be a different mix, as interesting, but a different mix. This is really specific to an American actor, but I think it is specific to Dan Fogler, really, who's his own country himself. But when it comes to English actors, I think most of English actors have a classical training. So they are hard workers. Many, many English actors would work in America without the American public realizing that they're actually not American. But they have a high capacity of work and training. They have a lot of stamina and resilience. And also many, I've discussed with a few of them, and they're, you know, for example, Jude Law. Jude has a training that allows him to play Hamlet on stage and to play in a movie where he has superpowers. And then he would be at ease with a comedy or a very dark film or a thriller or a film noir. So that is the versatility of their talent and their training. That's
They can adapt.
Yeah. And when it comes to, I don't like types, but French actors, I think we come with a different flavor, with a different vibe, because we stem from a different place. Also, the language is different, and the way we would speak English just sounds different, whatever your efforts, because of the percussion, the percussive aspect of the language. We hit the consonants in a different way. We put the emphasis on different places. Brontës has a very, very sweet English, and Brontës himself is a French actor, but he's not just French. I mean, no one is just anything, but Brontës has Brontës' background has roots in Latin America, in Chile, in Mexico, and he can perform in Spanish and English as well as French. But the method of acting is very different. And also Brontës in particular is very specific in his acting. He's playing at the moment, I think he's on stage playing Kafka's Monkey, which is a very, very interesting play and very physical. So we have that training too. There are schools there's a school in Paris called Jacques Lecoq that's very aimed at the work on the body. And many English actors have come to Paris to train at Jacques Lecoq before. I've never been to that school, but I'm a big fan of that school. They've trained here and went back to the country to develop other methods and other recipes of acting. So yeah, and when you put all that together, obviously it is highly interesting, because then people have something to exchange. They really have a genuine conversation through the technique of acting, and that's beautiful.
Yeah, so you talked about this kind of thing on set, I guess, with your colleagues on set for Fantastic Beasts, because yeah, you talked a lot about Eddie, Dan, and Brontës, of course, but there was Zoe Kravitz that you had a very powerful scene with two, and Catherine Waterston that we are big, big fans about.
So. Yeah, Catherine, for example, has a very, very subtle way of nuancing the things she does. And I have to say that as a professional actor, the good thing is that you keep learning from other people's experience, you know. And I remember someone who's a young actor and who's really fascinating, Ezra. Ezra was a yeah. huge source of inspiration and energy for me in some scenes because he was there in his presence and his intensity was mirroring mine. And he was making it easy to not pretend, but really be in the moment. You know, there's this long scene where I have this long monologue, and I remember very clearly the presence of everyone. I remember the intensity of Ezra's eyes, the intensity of Eddie's presence, the way the emotion burst in Zoe and you know, and Claudia Kim, who was there with this animal presence. She was just a person, but I could feel the animal there. I could feel Nagini behind, you know, she had all that. And Catherine, you know, it's really a mix of talents that is extremely pleasant because it carries you.
Yeah. No, that's why I wanted to talk about that with you, because as a fandom, we always say that we are really blessed with this casting, because that's, of course, we are seeing all of you through the screen, but we can feel that we are so lucky to have all of you. that's a really good thing to have to be passionate about.
Yeah, no, it's a real richness, and and everybody can relate. So yeah, I love that. That's one of the things I love about this job, is meeting other people from different places and realizing that you actually are very close. And also, I have this theory that you never know who you are until you meet the other. So the other is needed and indispensable. The other is vital to determine where you are and who you are. And, you know, I sometimes tell people that what's interesting in an embrace, when you embrace someone, or just when you touch another person, when imagine a baby, you're sitting in front of a baby, and very often the baby will touch you with his finger. He will just put his hand on your face. And something tells me that the baby is trying to define the contours of you. He's trying to define your shape, and he's trying to define where you stop and when and where he starts. So basically, the touch defines the person or the object you're touching, but by definition, it also defines where you stop, your own shape. If you levitate, if you never touch anything, if you don't even touch the floor, if you have no way, after a while you lose conscience of your shape, and you lose conscience of the limits of you. So what makes you feel your being is the contact with the other. So in the acting, it's the same thing. You can be the best actor in the world. If you act on your own, you're not interesting. What's interesting is the exchange, the confrontation with the other proposition. And I think you can apply that to everything in life.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
No, yeah, I think it's fascinating. It's really, really interesting. Yeah. So I wanted to talk about Paris because, mm-hmm. of course, in the movie they recreated a big part of the city, but a typical a specific part, it's the wizarding part of Paris. So you are one of the cast who know the real Paris, I guess. So what? How did you feel when you were on set in this Paris, in quotes, and being not so far from London, and how was that, and did you remember some details, some props or designs you liked or were surprised about?
Well, I have to say that I was fascinated with the sense of detail and the precision. Yeah. And I'm still amazed to this day, because I didn't know it was possible to go that far in the precision of a craft. These are people who would work for months, if not years, on the set, and the set was really huge. So most people would think, okay, so they just have this facade and they would just have this display and then everything else is a green screen. No. The set was huge. It was really blocks of buildings together. It was real streets where you could actually get lost, you know. So it's a serious set. The thing that made me smile, first, it was lovely for me as a French actor, as a French speaker, to see an imaginary Paris. And I recognized a few things from archives. I was able to recognize a few places, bits of places, squares. Like at some point, I think there was a little Place de la Concorde that was really sweet. I don't know if it made it to the cut, to the final cut. I don't think it is in the film.
No.
But it was a legendary scene that I really loved, and that didn't make its way to the
film. Wasn't it the now famous but never seen croissant scene that was on the Place de la Concorde?
It was the infamous croissant scene.
We always talk about that on the podcast because that's funny because now the croissant are famous everywhere.
Yeah. They're gonna be the most mysterious and famous scene, and so there was that one, and La Maison Flamel was really fascinating from the outside and from the inside, because it was really that beautiful, lovely, crooked house that defied gravity, and that was lovely. The thing that made me smile was that it was an interpretation of Paris. And for example, I noticed times things in names of shops, for example, where I would have spelt it differently. And I remember at some point I thought, hey, that's not the way you say it in French. So there was one or two instances where I thought, okay, that's a mistake, but it's lovely. And I remember another instance where I thought it was a mistake and I looked it up and they were right and I was wrong, because it was the way it was spelled at the time in the 20s. So no, it was, and that's an anecdote I said to people before, but, this Quidditch store that we used as a green room one day. There was a scene that was supposed to be shot. I think it was at the... It was around the time we were filming the scene where Eddie lures the zoo back into the suitcase with the little toy there. And during that scene, at some point, they were rehearsing something else in which I wasn't involved. And I was waiting in a green room, the room where we're waiting and to try and stay safe from staining our costume or wetting the makeup and hair department's work. So we were staying there, and that, for this particular instance, it was a Quidditch shop. And I started looking at everything inside there. And there were glasses that looked like crystal glasses. Obviously, those were antiques and things that were made like they were antique, but they were actual Quidditch balls or Quidditch, tools. And I thought, whoa, wait a minute. So at some point I thought, did Quidditch actually exist? Because it was so real, it was so well made, I just wanted to to buy something from that shop, you know, and take it as a souvenir. And I was convinced that there was a scene shot in there, and actually there was none. There was it was just because these people are crazy, you know, and when they do something, they can't stop, so they have to do it, you know, as soon as possible.
And they didn't have so enough work. They need to do more work too.
They absolutely they needed to occupy their crazy genius mind. Those are the things that that strike me. But everything was pretty real. I mean, obviously they've worked from documents, they're highly professional, and some of the things were actually shot in Paris. I know there were a few weeks where part of the team actually went to Paris to shoot, but everything else was done in Leavesden, and it felt really familiar. I'm really waiting the day where all this is going to become a museum, and people can go and visit and feel what it is from inside. You know, I've read some people were saying, I read somewhere someone saying, I loved Harry Potter more than Crimes of Grindelwald because Harry Potter made me want to be there and live there, and Crimes of Grindelwald is too dark. Yeah, but that's the vision of it. But if you were there, you would want to stay there, you know. Sometimes I would go on set when I didn't have to, you know, I had no scene, but I just liked to be in that set because it was just inspiring, you know, like in a dream. And when you put all the actors plus the extras in it, wow. As we say in French, ça a de la gueule. You know, it really is beautiful. You know, it's a killer.
Yeah, I guess at first, of course, as French, I was a bit disappointed that there was not really scenes shoot in Paris, because, of course, as any fans, I would try to find it.
Yeah.
But when you see what they can do in a set that they can control everything in, it's the result is so good that I don't blame them to choose to stay on set.
And it's really impressive. For example, Yusuf Kama's cave was, you know, in real proportions. It was really huge. I really felt like I was in the sewers of Paris. And it was really, you know, real human scale. It was impressive, but it would have been really complicated to try and do it in real sewers because where do you get electricity from? Where do you, you know, have the actors coming in from and all that? The other example is this one of the scenes at the Père Lachaise. At some point, we used an actual cemetery in London.
Yeah, it's Highgate, I think
so. Yeah. But the weather just didn't want to cooperate. You know, it was just something else. You know, it was raining all the time. Everything was muddy, and then it becomes dangerous because again we use electricity for all that, and then if you have an actor falling because he slipped on the floor, then you know you lose the actor for. I don't know how, you know, how. I think there was another film that was filming not far from us. Yeah, it was Mission Impossible. And I think it was Tom Cruise who twisted his ankle, and the whole production needed to be halted for 2 months at least.
Yeah.
And that's a catastrophe. Of course, you have insurances and stuff, but it means every other actor has to wait for 2 months for the lead to come back. So you don't want to have an accident. You don't want to put anyone's health at risk, and you want to protect the production. So at some point, the director, David Yates, took the decision to just bring everything back to the studios. So knowing David, it was a tough decision because he likes to have touches of reality. He likes when it's grounded, do something real. But it was also his job to make the right decisions, you know, and that's what it is. People might not realize, but to be a film director at that stage is a lot of responsibility. It's not, I mean, he's not just deciding, okay, I'm going to make the film that I want. No, he's doing the film that he's doing the best film that he can as close as possible to what they want with the reality of the production. And that's really admirable. And I have to say one word about them. That trio, David Heyman, David Yates, and J.K. Rowling. It was really impressive to see the three of them interact with their staff around, you know, the director of photography, Philip Houslow, and his first assistant, and the executive producers. They really work as a family, and that's really lovely to watch. I had no idea it was possible to have this sort of fine human kind decent relationship at that level of production when you're at the helm of a project that everybody is waiting and expecting, you know, and anticipating for. To be able to keep your cool, to make decisions and to stay so courteous, so respectful, so kind. I've never seen that before, you know, and I was really impressed. That's one of the things that impressed me the most in this production.
Yeah. No, it was you talked about that during the Q&A. It was really, really interesting to hear that, because of course we know these three people, we love these people, because they are with us as fans since the beginning, and or David Yates since most of the Harry Potter movies. So yeah, that's lovely to hear that it works so well with everyone. So yeah. So, as a conclusion, I just want to do a more fun things, because I know that you love Niflers.
Yeah.
And of course, it's one of our obsessions too. And I don't know if you noticed, but the Niffler is one of few Newt's beastie friends that who doesn't have a name. So in the Speak Beastie, we chose a name for the Niffler. Mm-hmm. So we name him Pastries.
Yeah.
In a homage for Jacob, of course. Mm-hmm. And we are still waiting this name to be official, because we shared this name to Dan Fogler, so we are counting on him to make that official. And now that we have baby nifflers, so we need to find names for the baby nifflers. So do you have any suggestion for the baby nifflers name?
I came up with one name.
Yeah.
I actually came up with two names, because let me double check. The name I invented was Knuckle Nip.
Okay.
And Knuckle Nip, because in slang, a knuckler is someone who's good with his hands and who can steal, who can mug, and basically who can nip. Nipping means many things, but it also means you know, when they call a bung nipper, means that you can bung is a wallet, and a nipper basically is someone who steals from a wallet. And I thought, okay, I like the way Knuckle Nip sounds.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like a picket for the boat record. So it could be a Rowling's name, I guess. So that works.
Yeah, Knuckle Nip. And another name I was thinking was just Fiddlers. Because the Fiddlers is a term that Hamlet, I think I'm not saying something stupid here, but I think Hamlet uses it at some point when he speaks to someone else about playing the flute. playing. Yeah, so and instead of saying fingers, he says fiddlers. But don't quote me on that, because it was a long time ago and I might be wrong.
No, but it sounds good. So for a name, it's all that matters. So yeah, now you just had to, we just have to send the names to, I guess, J.K. Rowling or maybe Eddie. So if Eddie used that, I guess it could be canon. Mm-hmm. So thank you again. It was really lovely to speak to you again, and really, really interesting.
That's my pleasure. My pleasure.
And yeah, we know that you can't say that, but we hope to see you soon in the the following movies.
We'll see. Yeah. I hope I love Yusuf Kama, and
yeah.
I love that character. I love the Wizarding World, and I'm very, very happy to be part of it. I was a happy spectator. I mean, I really loved the first one. I had no idea my path would cross that world, so that already made me super happy. And now that I have encountered Yusuf Kama, I really love this character, and I couldn't have wished for more. So
no, we want more too. So so yeah, thank you again, and maybe in a future episode when we will have more questions.
Okay, I'll be here.
Thank you. So yeah, so I guess we can say thank you again, William. It was really great to have you, and yeah, I hope that this other interview will not disappoint the listener, and or maybe the listener now expect an interview in each episode.
We wish.
We will try.
Time for the podcast question. Would you like to see Yusuf Kama in Fantastic Beasts 3, and what do you think his role could be in future movies? Feel free to drop us an owl on any of our social media outlets, or email us at speakbeastie@gmail.com. And as a member of the social media team, please let us know on social media. I will really enjoy reading those. And you can also feel free to leave us a review on iTunes.
And if you are looking to contact us, our Twitter and Instagram handle is @speakbeastie. Our Facebook is facebook.com/speakbeastie. Our Tumblr account is speakbeastiepodcast.tumblr.com. You can also support the show over on Patreon at patreon.com/speakbeastie. And if you're interested in more Fantastic Beasts fun on the off weeks of Speak Beastie, you can go over to the Common Room Correspondence, which is a fabulous perk of being a patron of this lovely show.
Yes, and it is.
You will hear the lovely vocal stylings of all three of us, plus yeah, two to three other ladies who are absolutely fabulous on the weeks that we do not have a Fantastic Beast, Speak Beastie episode.
If you're not on Patreon as well, you can also watch the episodes on our YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And Sophie has asked us to shout out Tina.
So yeah, Sophie, this is your Tina mention. We're sorry, it wasn't there.
Actually, there is a Tina mention
in there. Just saying Tina.
There is a Tina mention in part two of the interview, so.
Okay, that's fine. She'll be happy. We love you, Sophie.
Okay. I'm Juliana.
I'm Jennifer.
And I'm Marjolaine.
Case closed.